Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. I first heard of Jim Schaffner while he was still at Munson Marine, a specialty shop in suburban Chicago. He was soon to be tapped to join Salomon North America as a competition services rep, one of three in the U.S. at the time. Even when he was relatively new to Salomon's ranks, Jim wasn't shy about identifying what he perceived as the errors of management's ways. I vividly recall a meeting. Salomon convened meetings every few weeks, or so it seemed, when he seized on the subject of the cosmetics of the SX-81, the first spin-off of the phenomenally successful SX-91. This would have been around 1985 or so. The SX-81 that was in the pipeline was white, which in Jim's view undermined the brand's hard-won reputation as a purveyor of legitimate race boots. He chewed on this subject like a puppy with a new toy, relentlessly pressing his case. I admired his conviction and wasn't opposed to his point of view, but the Japanese subsidiary, which then accounted for more boots and bindings in North America, wanted a white boot, and no power on heaven or earth was going to change that. After Jim left Salomon in the late 1990s, his race background gave him cachet as a ski technician, enabling him to work out of his garage for 3 years, servicing the local race community. In due course, he would open his own store, where he built around his race community nucleus to create a viable shop that focused on the needs of racing prodigies, adult experts, and those aspiring to be experts. Jim was very much a hands-on owner, and he continued to build an elite clientele of both established U.S. team members and up-and-coming athletes. His reputation as one of the best boot fitters in the country was complemented by his talents as a coach, a level of engagement with our sport few other boot fitters can match. His work with the race community gave Jim instant street cred as an elite boot technician, earning a reputation for fitting prowess that landed him on the faculty of Master Fit University, the gold standard for fitting instruction worldwide. Please note, dear listeners, that Master Fit Enterprises, the owner and operator of Master Fit U, is the sponsor of this week's podcast. We're happy to have them because we believe wholeheartedly in what they do. Returning to the matter at hand, we're going to talk to Jim about the current state of the boot fitting world, including the auspicious arrival of a new shell technology from Lang and the adoption of the BOA cable retention system by several major bootmakers. It's always a pleasure to pick your information-packed brain, my dear friend. And dear listeners, please join me in welcoming the man who is perhaps America's best bootfitter, Jim Schaffner, to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Jackson. And don't want to overplay it or underplay it, but I absolutely enjoy hanging out with you. And part of how this came together was just you and I skiing together and testing skis together, which led us to this conversation here today. So thank you for that.
My pleasure. Let's go back in time to the misty past. Who first attached your feet to skis and where did that happen?
Well, so I grew up in a suburb north of Chicago, and my parents had learned to ski in the late 50s by driving across the lake to, I believe, Boyne or perhaps Caber Fay, where at that time, I believe it was Stein Erickson had made a stop on his way west and was actually running the ski school there. And so my parents had learned to ski in the 50s, and I was born in 1958. So as soon as I was able, which was about age four, I was taken on the trips with them. And so my first experiences were at a pretty young age.
Do you belong to a little ski club?
The beautiful thing of growing up in a Chicago suburb is they had a club that was called the Snowflake Ski Club, and it ran kind of all up the North Shore of Chicago. And they would leave in the wintertime on Saturday mornings early. You'd have to be at the rec center. It'd be an hour to an hour and a half going to the closest ski areas in the Chicago area, which was like Wilmot and Alpine Valley, Four Seasons, Villa Olivia. At any rate, you'd get on the bus and it was without parents, which was a great thing. And you're with kids your own age and you got placed into groups by the different letters of recognition of the skills you possessed. And so I kind of worked my way up through the letters at the Snowflake Ski Club.
And where did you do most of your skiing in your youth? Was there one area that got most of your attention?
As a family, we used to do a lot of weekends or vacations in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is a pretty amazing place in terms of the amount of snow they get and the cold. The skiing isn't so amazing, but at any rate, it was family vacations the most. But then locally, I ended up at a place called Wilmot Mountain, which was literally on the border of Illinois and Wisconsin. So grew up there mainly, and especially once I was old enough to drive, then it was about an hour away and they had night skiing. And so that was like absolute magic as a kid to have the freedom of having a car and the ability to go and hang out in a state where the drinking age was 18.
How old were you when you began to work at Munson Marine?
So once again, it relates to the car. So about the time I could drive, because Munson Marine was actually a bit west and north of Chicago. And so it was about 30 miles away. And so once I had a driver's license, so 16, I began to work for those guys. I can't say enough good things about the people who I worked for that were my mentors there, you know, are part of the story for today, because that was a ski shop that had guys that were really into the performance of ski equipment.
I have to say, as someone ahead of you at Salomon by just a couple of years, Munson Marine had an excellent reputation. They were well known outside of their market area for the quality of their work they did and the quality of the clientele that they had in a part of the world where the clientele was, shall we say, a bit iffy.
Well, I just wanted to say this about the Midwest, Jackson. Having come from there, which I think is one of the greatest places to come from, the way I viewed it was that because there was not really great skiing there, Midwesterners love to talk about the sport, I think, more than any other part of the United States. And I think it falls down to the lack of actual skiable terrain and challenging terrain leads everybody kind of sitting around just talking about it.
Where and when did you start your race career as an amateur skier?
My dad introduced me to ski racing when I was right about 10 or 11 or so. It was through the Wilmot race team that he signed me up for. And there happened to be a really interesting flamboyant coach by the name of Alan Kildow, which, to tie some things together here, that's Lindsay Kildow's dad. And Alan happened to be from the Midwest. He was my very first coach, highly energetic. He had been coached by Eric Seiler, who, you know, as a coach, I think has a lot of energy, and he transferred that energy very well to Alan Kildow. That's what actually where the bug bit me, was just going to dry land. And the first few times I skied with Alan Kildow, I was absolutely bit by the bug.
So you followed a path, which I'm sure is fairly typical for an amateur racer, got better and better and moved up through the ranks. But eventually you made the jump to pro racing. What triggered that and how did that career go?
Well, that was pretty straightforward. I actually had hit the wall as a FIS athlete, where my goal, like so many kids in the U.S., was to make the U.S. ski team. It was, I think, late 70s-ish. I had actually been invited to a downhill camp with the U.S. ski team in Sunday River, Maine. And that camp ended up, because of weather and how it typically can happen in the East, it didn't go. And there was just something about, you know, like almost being there and then having the rug pulled out from under me, where I said to myself, you know what, I got to move on. I got to do something different. And so I accepted a scholarship at Northern Michigan University to go to college. And it was while I was in that process of kind of refinding what my goals were, and while I was in school, this pro tour kind of popped up in the Midwest, and I certainly wasn't enjoying school, and I wasn't enjoying at that time ski racing the way it worked at school, because it was hard, you know, going to class and training and traveling and trying to keep up with things. And so when this pro tour came along, I absolutely just jumped on it, and I said, that's for me. And one of the things that I think led me there was the coach I'd been traveling with had used dual format in training quite a bit. In my head, I'm thinking, all right, I've trained this way. I've got some skill in this way. I know kind of how I feel when I get somebody next to me on the course. And so it was kind of this natural progression of saying, I think I can do that. And I think I can do it well. And so that's when I quit school and jumped on the pro tour.
You say pro tour as though it was a highly organized affair. I'm not so sure that was really true at your time. Didn't you have to sort of chase the events around the country?
Well, absolutely. So that was right in transition when the World Pro Tour, which was run by Bobby Adi, kind of self-imploded. There'd been a major issue in the spring in Mammoth that involved some athletes that were protesting the way things were working on the tour, and TV was involved, and it caused a collapse of Biotti's program. But there had been some of these smaller regional tours that existed. And so when the US Pro Tour imploded, Peugeot stepped up, and they were doing like these regional tours, as well as there was still the Coors American Tour going on in the Rocky Mountains. And then aside from that, there were some really fun tours, like in New Mexico, where you could go and there were purses. And so for us in the Midwest, one, because we had snow problems, and two, because we were in the middle of the country and you could get anywhere quickly, we just get out Ski Racing Magazine and just look at, see what pro races were available. And a lot of times, you know, on a whim, we would jump in a van and head out and see if we could barnstorm across the country and make some cash. So yeah, it was a really funny time for pros, because you had really good pros in different parts of the country that might have been attached to one tour, like the Eastern Peugeot or the Coors Tour, that really weren't traveling much. And so it kind of put us in this interesting position of kind of chasing money and chasing points. Yeah, at the time, it was definitely transitional in the pro arena, but it was a great time for me because I was able to make money and I had a really good time in my early 20s.
Did you finish well?
Yeah. I mean, on the Midwestern Peugeot, I was second overall in my first year, I think 10 points away from the car, which was frustrating. And then in my second year, had an even better year, but didn't do so well on any one tour because I was skiing on a number of different tours that season.
So you got pretty visible, I would assume, to people like Solomon over that time. What were you doing when Solomon hired you? I believe you began as a competition services rep.
Correct. And where I think that connection had come from, it actually goes back to my last years as an amateur and the introduction of the 727 binding. So I had developed a pretty good relationship with a number of the reps working at Munson Marine. And as I was ski racing, towards the end, I was sponsored by Solomon. And this was before the boots, just before the boots got introduced. So that was really the beginning of my connection. And I was through Brad White, who was a promotional rep in the Midwest. And he found that I was pretty easy to work with, and I gave him good feedback. And there was an incident which, you know, may have had some long-term effect. And that is the very first run, the very first time that I skied on a 727 binding was at the request of Brad White. And it happened to be at one of the early season races in the Midwest called a Mid-Am. Brad had said, okay, we got these new bindings. I think we should put them on your skis. I want to get them out there. I want people to see what's going on. And I, you know, kind of bought in. I didn't think much about it. Got up for the first run and won the first run of this mid-am. And it was a slalom, and Brad was all fired up and, you know, pretty excited about the fact that they had this brand new binding. I just skied on it. Everything worked well. So second run comes around. I'm all amped up. I'm leading the race. I'm thinking to myself, man, I'm going to win a NORAM. So amped up. I get in the gate and push out, double eject from both heels of the Solomon 727 bindings. And I might be like gilding the lily a touch here, but I'm pretty sure that's how I ended up getting hired, because Brad White felt so bad about, about pushing me to do that, you know, not knowing if the binding was ready or not per se, that I think he helped push me through the pipeline. So I could be making this up, or it could be the truth, but all I know is that that's the one connection to Solomon that I remember leading further down the road. That incident with the binding then turned into some work on early work on the boots. And again, that connection to the guys at Solomon helped lead me to eventually a job in racing services. At that time, the brand really was an amazing place to be in terms of the people that were being hired there, and the training that was available was absolutely leading the industry at the time. And so you couldn't go to one of these meetings, you know, without a, like sometimes a third party educator coming out in to teach you how to develop interpersonal relationships with clients, or technical stuff on how bindings work, for example, and teaching and training. So it was really a fun time to be in that company, because there were so many tremendously talented, smart people that were passing that information on.
We're going to jump ahead in time. And why did you end up leaving Solomon? And can you just briefly trace the path you took from Solomon, I believe, to Marker, and then ultimately to Starthouse?
probably the major event was in 94. I got married and I was living in the Boston area at the time in Newburyport. The office at that point for Salomon had been moved back to Georgetown, that much closer to France. And I think an easier transition to Europe for us Americans and an easier transition to America for the Europeans. But I got married in 94, was living back east, and we found out we were pregnant. At that point, it was pretty clear to me that I had probably the best ski job in the entire industry, the ability to ski over 100 days, travel around the world, work hard, but not have ultimate bottom line responsibility for the company's success. It was a pretty good gig. And at that time when we got pregnant and we're living in the East, my wife and I at the time just looked at each other and said, there's no way we're raising our kids in kind of the North Sea Coast part of the world. Not that there's anything wrong with Boston or anything wrong with the Northeast, other than I lived up on this lake that was a reservoir for the town of Amesbury, Mass, which is right on the New Hampshire border. And the water for the town came from this lake that we lived on. It was a great little lake called Lake Attitash. And I'd go into town to this little diner cafe place. I'd sit on a stool and talk to my fellow townspeople from Amesbury. And they'd say things like, hey, so where do you live? And I say, oh, I live up in over in Lake Attitash. And they'd look at me and they say, yeah, I heard of that. I mean, we were 50 miles away from Boston. And most of the people in that diner I was eating at hadn't been there yet. So of all the goofy things, here I am, married, pregnant. And I went back to my boss and I said, hey, boss, I think I need to make a change here. We're going to start raising a family and I need to get off the road, but I really want to stay with the brand. And we kind of brainstormed to see, well, what the possibilities were. And at that time, the easiest thing seemed to be to take a sales territory, but there was nothing available at that time. And so not that I was panicked, but I had to make a plan here. At that point, my wife and I said, well, we're going to need to kind of move back one to where we want to be, which was in the West. And I just happened to have a piece of property at Alpine Meadows at that time, or a house that I'd actually built just as I was moving to Boston. So it was an easy move. And at the time, Marker had a position open. And one of my dear friends, Kirk Langford, who also worked for you at one point,
right,
he and I started at Salomon in the same week in racing service, got along great, loved skiing together. And he happened to be at the time the sales manager at Marker. And so he found me a territory and a position right where I had a house. So I ended up moving then to Marker. So kind of settled into Tahoe lifestyle. The next transition led me to actually working locally in Tahoe. Took a job working for a great retailer in Tahoe. It was Porter Ski and Sport. They had a multiple store, high-end specialty chain store. I went to work for them as buyer, merchandiser, and trainer for their staff in boot fitting and ski prep. And so that's the transition then that led to me eventually going into business for myself. So I worked for them for 2 years. During that time period, actually entered into negotiations with the owner of Porter's about buying the business and spent about 12 months on that process, only to find out at the end that it really didn't look like something that was going to work. So at that point, I actually just quit. I didn't have a plan, didn't have a job. And in that week that I quit, a good friend of mine who I'd worked with when he was with the US ski team and then at Stratton Mountain School phoned me to say he was starting a new academy in Sugar Bowl in Tahoe and was wondering if I had any of my boot tools around. Because he had some new kids that needed a look. At that point, you know, I didn't have a job and I had a nice little space in my house. And I told him on the phone, I said, well, I'm not really set up at the moment, but I'm going to go dig out all my tools and let's start bringing the kids in next week. And in the process of that phone call and the next week, the idea was hatched to open a company called Schaffner Racing Services. And that really was the beginning of my store, my business. And that act of starting to work with those particular kids at that time kind of helped really solve a number of problems for me. One, being close to home, literally in my basement, and two, getting off the road completely and having plenty of time for my kids and my family.
You spent 3 years as a private, if you will, I mentioned that because you weren't working in a particular store, ski tuner, before getting into retail. But you had been at retail with Roger Kahn, who was the owner at Porter's, and Porter's was one of the best specialty shops in and around the Tahoe area. I think they had three or four locations. Did your time at Porter's help inform your notions of how to run a store on your own?
Yes, I learned a tremendous amount from working on the retail side with Roger Kahn at Porter's for a number of different reasons. And I don't think I could have had the success I've had with my own business without that interim experience.
What were your biggest obstacles / frustrations as a specialty retailer?
I think the first big battle was distribution. On the one hand, you could argue I had an advantage because I worked as a rep in that territory for both Salomon and Marker, and I knew the players. So it wasn't too hard to go and talk to the other retailers, but you and I both know that talking to the other retailers about what you're planning to do in business versus what they do in business is not legal. I took this strategy of going to the supplier and saying, look, we don't want to sell the retail stuff. We're not going to upset the apple cart. We're not going to upset the existing retailers. We just want to do race and pro business, which no one's doing very well. And you as a company are actually ending up supplying a lot of the equipment to Rec. So what if we just open with your brand, but that's all we do? And yes, that was a great strategy. And yes, I got distribution of everything I wanted within two seasons. The only problem was I might have fibbed a little bit because the intent never was to just sell race and pro, but that would be the obvious hook to circumvent this whole argument with people about whether or not, you know, we're going to be a worthy retailer and, you know, whether we deserved distribution. That's how the business progressed into this little niche-y race / pro shop to a full-blown retail establishment. There's not as many good ski shops around as there used to be. And I can tell you, as a guy that's in the business of training boot fitters and guiding end users to good boot fitters, it's getting to be hard for me to say, well, go see so-and-so in this town or in this ski area or in this part of the world, and they'll get you all squared up, because those guys are starting to disappear.
I created Jackson's List specifically to try to address this problem. I wanted to be able to find the specialty shops that you could send a friend to and know that they were going to get taken care of. And it's usually taken care of by person X. In other words, it's not just the shop. It is the guy, normally. Sometimes it's the gal, but most usually it's the guy in the shop that you want to see. Because if you go to that same shop, but you get the person they hired the week before, he's not going to give you the same level of service as the guy would. And that dilution of talent, fewer and fewer members of the guy group and more people who are fresh out of nowhere. In other words, they don't even have the advantages that you might have had growing up as a skier. And they're thrown out in the sales floor because there aren't any other warm bodies willing to show up for work. So you don't know, as the third party trying to make a recommendation, am I really sending you to the right place or the right guy? Or is the right guy now gone and that's no longer the right place?
Well, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head. My lead up to a lifetime devotion to the ski business came out of that simplistic formula of there being the guy in a place that would completely buff you out. The hook for me occurred when I was really young. As I'd mentioned earlier, I grew up in a suburb of Chicago, and there's a town right next to Chicago called Evanston, and there was a fly fishing shop called Tackle Tires, like, you know, to tie tackle. So it was a fishing shop in the summer, and in the wintertime, they turned into a ski shop. And there was this old gentleman, and at the time, I couldn't tell you how old he was because I was just a kid myself. My classic vision of a older, wise gentleman, gray hair, balding, glasses, and the whole family would get in the station wagon with all our existing equipment, drive down to Tackle Tires, and the moment you walked in, you knew you were somewhere special. It smelled like pine tar and wax. You know, it had the smell. It was kind of dark and dank wood floor. And then there's this wise old guy that's going to know that when you put your hand up, your wrist goes to here on the tip of the ski. So, you know, Jimmy's going to get Carrie's hand-me-downs and Danny's going to get Jimmy's skis. And then we're going to go over to the boot area and he buffs us all out. And that experience of doing that for about 10 years as a kid, it is somehow how I am where I am today. I don't know quite how to explain it, but I can explain that in this modern era, the smell is gone, and that, you know, bespeckled, gray-haired, balding guy is me. And my task is no different than that guy in the 60s who was there to make sure that our family had an amazing experience in a sport that he loved. You know, I hate to say it in such a simplistic way, but that, you know, there's the disconnect, there's the hook, there's the deal where you say, well, why are you in this business? You know, why did you take that job, or why did you do this? And there's less and less of a response about kind of the sexiness of it, the coolness of it, this idea of being a ski bum, which, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s was still pretty damn romantic, doesn't really exist anymore because of how things have changed on the supply side, the retail side, and the ski area side of how you ski, where you ski, are all of the things that have seemed to have disappeared from the hook that got me going. And essentially for the product that we've tried to deliver to our clients goes back to Tackle Tires in the 60s.
Switching gears, let's go over to a different role or a different hat that you have worn. Somewhere during your ownership of Starthouse, you became an instructor at MasterFit University and a perennial tester at the MasterFit boot test. Just for the record, who reached out to whom initially? Or as Madeline Kahn said memorably in Blazing Saddles, was the feeling mutual?
I would say it was probably mutual or mutual. It was based on my time at Porter's, actually, where initially those guys came to us was about when the Superfeet company was starting to shift away from using cork. And at one point, Porter's had bought full on into Superfeet cork footbeds. So it was through some initial conversations with the MasterFit boys, Steve Cohn and Jeff Rich, about switching product within the store, which I viewed that. And I said, okay, this is one of the things that's, you know, taking more time than it should. And the net result, the way we're currently doing it, isn't going well. And so it was that initial kind of sales pitch, if you will, from the Instaprint guys that led to a teaching position with MasterFit.
Now, I've attended your courses at MasterFit, and I've seen the diligence that you bring to the annual MasterFit boot test. You've tested just about every boot made in the last, what, quarter century?
Pretty much.
And over the years, your opinion has also been sought out by just about every major boot supplier.
Yes.
So you're familiar, therefore, with the R&D and the execution of virtually all boot brands going back for what would pass for most people's adult life. Can you tell me, over the arc of that intimate awareness of what the boot world looks like, how well is the customer being served? Is the average boot improving? Is the public being well served by this sector?
Well, in general, I would say no, but there's some bright spots. The general part, which I'll give the answer no to, is that if you think back to the times when we all started this sport and plastic boots kind of evolved somewhere very late in the 60s, when we first started to see either injected or some of the earliest boots were poured polyurethane boots. But from the existence of the plastic shell, you know, I would say that the fit and the shape of a boot was probably a relatively good reflection to, you know, the shoes that were being built at the time. There was time when like a company like Nordica had one shape and they had one design and they injecting it out of all different materials to get it to act differently for a aggressive high performance skier or a beginner. And each brand kind of, you know, would have its shape and they would run that. And it wasn't great because it didn't identify all the different feet out there. In the 40 years that followed from that time point, the suppliers have all been in search of these lasts that work universally, which once again, has never really been done well or perfectly by anybody, because I think it's an impossible task. But bottom line is that today, I think they've dumbed down the market to have the in-store boot fit experience be such that you just pull one off the shelf, put it on someone's foot, more or less try and match it to the numbers that are on the box so that the person doesn't complain at all and says, yes, I'll take these, thank you very much, and goes off and skis. And the problem with that dumbing down, if you will, is I would contend that all of the boots that are being sold into the market these days are in that fluffy bunny category of pull it out of the box, put it on someone's foot. If they go, oh, this is amazing, you ask for their credit card and you send them off. But the reality is that for people who are interested in skiing and skiing well, the shells need to be closer to the shape of the foot, almost back to some of these shapes that came out of the early 70s, late 60s, and throughout the 70s, that were actually relatively good fitting boot designs that were on a last that's way closer to the 95s and the 98s that are being sold today versus the 100 millimeter 4 foot and the 102 or bigger. And I think what's interesting about it, and I think this is where I know I get frustrated with the supply side, in that they feed that. They feed that to the retailer. And, you know, just for what it's worth, and I'm not much into, conspiracy theory on this, but it sure feels like the goal long term for a lot of the suppliers is to not necessarily have to rely on a brick and mortar store with a boot fitter. They generalize the last, make fit improvements to them out of the box, or ways to improving the fit out of the box that you can do at home. And in theory, that's going to eliminate the need for the boot fitter. You know, the only struggle with that is that to begin with, even with the boot fitters, we're not properly sizing boots. The statistics still show that there's way more boots that are oversized and misfit than boots that are correctly sized. And the comfort level of the retailer and the supplier with themselves don't exactly provide information to the consumer that leads to that positive end. And specifically what I'm talking about is on a boot box today, the markings and the numbers don't really relate to the reality of the person who's sitting in front of you. You're going to use a Mondo point length measurement and a width measurement theoretically at the widest point in the boot, but not necessarily where the widest point of that person's foot lines up. And that's how we say that a boot is this volume or this length, is based off of those two principles, which don't exactly, you know, make a love match to most skiers.
There are two primordial points on a boot that we look to match them up with a skier. And one we've been talking about are the fit numbers of a last that is low volume, medium volume, or high volume, or even beyond that spectrum. But the other side of that is the flex index. And the flex index is phony baloney from the start. The fit index should at least at some point be true in the line. Let's say for the 26.5, those measurements are at least valid for that boot. But the flex index bows before no man. It is completely fictitious. And everybody has used it to their own commercial ends, never mind the technical needs or what is desirable for skiers. Right now, the top flex index for a citizen skier, and I call them a citizen skier because they are not racers, is what is called a 130. And the low end is somewhere, God forbid, in the 60s and 70s. How stiff a boot should people be in? In other words, we have this huge range of availability going from 60 to 130. What's the real range available or that the skier should be asking for?
I will give you my answer, but my answer in general is going to be related to the business that I currently own, which is that in terms of those two numbers that you're talking about, the flex number and or the volume or the width number, we're off in a field standing by ourselves. So our number one selling boot out of the 1,200 boots that we sell in a year, the number one flex for men is a 130. And for women, it's either a 100 or a 110. And there's a few clinkers in there where companies like Technica have gone to having like a 105 and a 115. But we generally, for the women, it's somewhere around a 100 or a 110. In the masses, if you will, of how boots are sold, ski shops will carry that entire range that you described of like men from 60 to 150 and for women of, you know, 60 to let's say 120 or even 130. But for us, we're super narrow because just average skier, as long as their ankle joint functions normally, can, you know, ski up and ski down. And it's also important to know that those numbers that you indicated already are kind of funny numbers. There isn't a whole lot of accuracy. Like today's 130 is not a stiff boot. You know, I hate to say it, but today's 130.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, today's 130 is really kind of like an old school 120 or 115 or something like that. So even that makes it a little bit false. But that being said, we sell mainly 130s and or on the male side, and on the female side, somewhere in the 100 to 110 range. And then the other point, going back to what I was talking about, lasts from the 70s, the majority of our boot sales are in the low volume category, the 98s. We don't even sell, well, I shouldn't say we don't even sell. In the 102 last, we buy maybe 20 pair a year out of 1,200 boots. So the majority of our sales are in 98 millimeter lasted boots or 4 foot boots. And, you know, we sell a handful of 100s, maybe 25% are 100s, 50 to 60% are 98 millimeter lasts. We have a percentage of low volume 92s, 95s that are for racers specifically, and or people with very thin, low volume feet. And like I said, above 100, you know, we might sell 20 pair a year. To me, that's not a forced deal. That's a reality-based boot fitting, in where we actually assess and measure the feet properly and don't just look at the Mondo point length and the width at the ball of the foot, because those two things are totally adaptable on boots. And if the forefoot is that thick, it's that thick everywhere else. And if the forefoot is that thin, the whole boot is thinner everywhere else. And yes, you might have to do a little bit more adjusting, but for the most part, feet have not changed dramatically since the 70s, when plastic boots were first being formed. And that, to me, is the disconnect between the industry, the supply side, and the retail side. Is the supply side is pushing these ridiculously voluminous boots that don't touch, don't hurt, and don't ski very well because they don't touch.
The problem is rampant in both areas, I think. In other words, people are buying boots that misfit because the misfitting boot feels more comfortable initially, and nobody has the nerve to coach them into what's more correct. And the same thing is true of flex. People come in with a certain expectation, maybe because their last boot had a certain number on it, and they think that's their right number. But there's no question that boots are generally getting softer. And a 130 of today is incredibly soft compared to a 130 of, say, 10 or 15 years ago. But the manufacturer, he would love if every retailer adopted your philosophy, because they make more money on a 130 than they do on any other boot in the product line. But that's not what they sell. The description you've just heard, dear listeners, about what Jim had been selling at Starthouse pertains not one iota to the general public or the sales curve of the manufacturers, which are going to peak somewhere between 100 and 110, not more than that, for men, and somewhere definitely below 100 for women. Why? Because they think that's what people want and what people need, because they really don't go back and re-examine foundationally what the hell is going on with putting this human being in this hard plastic shell, and what do we have to do when we throw them in motion to make their skiing not just fun, but safer, because they're in a good body position or they're being held properly, and they'll have the confidence of knowing that their whole balance system is working because they have a custom insole that's connecting with their arch, which is connecting to their vestibular canal, which helps them stay upright and in balance. People don't realize this isn't just about performance or trying to get you into a stronger boot. It's to make you safer and more comfortable. It's just what you think is not going to happen is exactly what the goal is. Let somebody who knows what they're doing take over, and you are not going to end up in the boot you thought you belonged in.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's further compounded, not by the direction of the ski industry, but by the direction in which footwear is now acquired worldwide. And the way that footwear is acquired worldwide is you walk into an establishment that has boxes of shoes on the floor and a sample of one sitting on top of the boxes, or the samples are on the wall and the boxes are on the floor, and you self-select. You look at the shoes on the wall and say, oh, I like that color. That's a good price. I like that brand. And then you walk over to the boxes and you find the one that you think is yours because you think you're a 9 because that's what you bought last time, or that's what, you know, you kind of remember your number is. And so you find the 9 in that color, in that model, in that brand, and you open the box, you take the paper out, you put your foot in it. Maybe you lace it up, maybe you don't. Maybe you walk around in it for 5 minutes, maybe you don't, but you buy it and say, okay, I got my shoes. And so if that's how we acquire, you know, like 99.9% of our footwear, why would ski boots be acquired any differently? So why couldn't I just go to a place where there's samples on the wall and I just go look at the sample I want and the price I want? I like that color. And you say, do you have that one in my size? I'm a 9. You try it on, and if it doesn't bug you, you buy it. The inherent problem is that in ski boots, they don't work the way shoes do. They have to be relatively tight for all of the reasons you just explained, and that control, balance, and ultimately fun and pleasure in the sport will come from boots that are properly fit, not boots that you either have to overbuckle, can't get tight enough, can't find your center of balance, can't flex, flexes too much. And those are all things that you can only get on the guided tour of going into a ski shop with an expert that has the tools and the knowledge. And the tools and the knowledge in most cases in boot fitting are your eyes, your ears, and your hands. It's not like it's specialty stuff that no one else has to make these modifications or these modifications. It's simply doing good assessment, listening to what the customer is saying, and helping them work through resistance to either pressure they're feeling or discomfort or balance standing right in the ski shop that doesn't feel good. And you stand a much higher chance of having a competent skier on the hill that continues to do the sport well into their later years, because it sure seems to be a sport that you can do until you die. But with properly fit and tuned equipment, you can have fun and pleasure all the way to the end. I think one of the strongest points here is the disconnect between the experience on the snow and the boot fit. You described what could go wrong. You know, I'm kind of knowledgeable enough to know that it's not going wrong every single day at every single ski area around the world because of how people acquire their footwear. It's not any more complicated than that.
Returning to what's going on in the boot market today, in an unusual cosmic coincidence, both of the major boot design archetypes, the two-piece overlap shell and the three-piece shell, which normally has an external tongue, both these designs fiddled with their pivot points, which has an enormous influence on the boot's flex behavior. I want you to comment, and you can comment at length if you like, or keep it brief if you like, but please comment on what Lang did with its shadow design that's just introduced this year. And Dalbello also fiddled with its pivot point on its very different Cabrio design. Talk to our dear listeners about these two breakthroughs, really, in modern boot design.
This is right in my wheelhouse, because the question you asked a while back about, you know, Salomon boots and pivot points and blockages, that really was probably the heart and the soul of solving the conundrum of Salomon rear entry boots for high performance skiing back in the day. And I think what has now occurred in those two examples you mentioned, one being Lang's shadow, is those guys have kind of found a different mechanical way to solve this conundrum that existed back in the inventive days of Salomon, of separating out the performance of the boot from the fit. And I think the bottom line is, if you imagine that you could change the flex of a boot by just simply tightening or loosening the buckles, that is one way in which it was approached and has been approached for years. But those concepts were not independent, and it's completely wrapped up within itself, that the way that you buckle the boot and the way that the boot skis end up affecting the fit. And I think that's one of the things that I think Lang has come up on with the shadow, is by redesigning the way that the pivot functions, gives this boot kind of this mechanical advantage over the skis and over gravity and over the sport of skiing while allowing the fit to be pure and perfect inside that design. I can't say enough good things, first of all, about the Shadow. And I think what's interesting about Shadow is it won't prove itself as a success on the hill as much as it will in the shop. That the internal fit of the boot and the way that it feels on initial fit is how it's going to win this season. But the real jewel is how it actually skis based on this new concept of the pivot point and bringing energy to and taking energy from what the cuff does over the lower of the boot. And that's the genius of it. But as I said, a lot of times that doesn't get recognized because the consumer is probably more wrapped around the fit of the boot than they are the way that the boot performs. And you certainly won't feel any lack of performance. So that becomes like a constant. But I don't see how the average consumer is going to jump up and down and go, oh my God, that Lang Shadow, best boot I ever skied in. But I could tell you that the way that it works functionally, it could damn well be the best boot that some people have ever skied in. To me, that one's an amazing story of taking the basic principles of boot design, which is to be able to somehow separate the performance from the fit and hit it out of the park with amazing fit. So there's the Lang. On the Del Bello side, I have to say that I've been a naysayer of Cabrillo designs pretty much my entire adult life. Although I have to say there was a time when Reichle was fighting the same thing Salomon was fighting back in the day with rear entry. But now in the current iteration, this latest redesign of Del Bello's three-piece shell, major improvement. And it was the first time that I ever slid into a Cabrillo boot and could actually get it to feel on snow the same way as my four buckle overlaps did. So I think they've done a tremendous job in reshaping where the boot works from and where it pivots from and where it evolves its power from, while not giving up on that one principle of the three-piece shell, which is having the flex governed by that third piece or the external tongue in that rib fashion, which gives power and rebound. And, you know, it's why that boot was so successful back in the day, or that design was so successful back in the day for downhill racing, speed on long, straight, fast skis, and still remains a huge advantage in mogul skiing, in the ability for that brand of boot or that style of boot to contain the foot with the plastic shell that is not related to the ribbed tongue, which gives it its response, its rebound, and its power. I'm glad you brought those up because those two boots, I think, are kind of the best technical story of delivering that separation of fit and flex on the hill.
I think that both designs are the best executions of their archetypes that I've seen in my lifetime. And the fact that they both sort of came on the market at the same time, the Shadow design, I think, has overpowered Del Bello somewhat just from a marketing standpoint. They have a great foundation in the market. The Del Bello is not quite as widely spread through the U.S. market. But from a technical standpoint, pull all the marketing and all the, you know, market share numbers out of it. Equally important advancement in both designs, which have not advanced by and large for a great deal of their lifetime. So this is, in fact, a big watershed moment. But you and I both know that no matter how important the change in the pivot points are in Shadow or in the Cabrio, they will both be overshadowed by another phenomenon that has found its way to Alpine boots, and that is the BOA internal cable adjustment that allows you to twist a dial and affect the fit volume in the forefoot of the boot. Talk to me about what BOA can do for the consumer, what it's good for, who might say, ooh, that sounds great, and what does it not do?
This has been a very hotly debated subject about BOA, and the naysayers have gone right to the durability potential, the, you know, not bringing anything to the party, where I have to say that as I've looked at it more closely over the last 6 months, BOA is here to stay. And BOA is going to be in greater numbers, you know, tomorrow than it is today. So let's let that statement stand for a moment, that it's here and it's not going anywhere. But the second half of that now is to say, okay, so what does it do? And that's another problem that I think we have, in that it is nothing more fundamentally than another way of closing the boot that's different than buckles. it can do it easily and simply by twisting a knob and hearing a click and a wind up. So you know it's getting tighter. You can feel it tightening around your foot. The issue with BOA will be is that it won't be the same for every supplier. And the reason why is that it's the application of the boot itself and the BOA combined that makes it work together. And in some cases, especially in intro here, some of the companies started there with the design. They started with reshaping lower shells to function with the BOA. The problem you'll run into in year one is those will probably be more successful in terms of just their overall out-of-the-box fit, because the other way of producing BOA on the boots was to simply take existing shell designs and simply make attachment points and flow points from where the cable goes on a shell that actually had been designed to have four buckles. Where the rubber will meet the road, and this will all come together, is at the point where all of the suppliers that are using BOA have all gone through the process with BOA to readjust or redesign the shapes of the lowers so that when you twist the dial and use the cable, it has some effect on how it holds the foot. That effect will be better, I think, when it's ground from the ground up design versus trying to retrofit the BOA to existing models. So all that being said, you know, what's BOA do? It's a different way of getting in and out of the boot. Is it a game changer? I'm going to say no, straight up, not even a waffle and go, oh, is this going to change my life? I would say no, that's not what it's going to do, because it's simply a closure system. And, you know, I could make an argument, and I won't name names yet, unless you put a flame, you know, or some bamboo shoots under my fingernails. But some of the companies that have jumped wholeheartedly into BOA are presenting it on boots that are so freaking voluminous that it doesn't matter whether it's a cable or a buckle. You'd still need to throw a gerbil and two tampons and a trail map inside.
These are not typical boot fit aids, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, to get the boot to close on your foot. So, you know, show me a BOA on a boot that's a 106 or a 104, and I will show you someone who cannot change direction, control gravity, and ski with a smile on their face anytime conditions get difficult. And that's got nothing to do with BOA. That's just simply where the supplier has chosen to put the emphasis. And it's at least worth throwing out there that there have been a number of twists and turns in the direction of ski equipment that's based on a theory, that's based on marketing, that's based on doing something different just to be doing something different. And so there is a good chance there's a little bit of that going on. Not to say that there is fundamentally anything wrong with BOA. I actually think that it closes the boot nicely. However, it doesn't necessarily do it any better or any worse at this point than buckles do. And there's more of this story yet to be written. And the part of the story that I think will be the best part is when it really begins from the bottom up in design. And, you know, we could potentially see BOA on the top cuffs of the boots. So that's my maybe 20,000 foot look down on the whole thing. My personal issue as a boot fitter is currently BOA frustrates the hell out of me because I can't get inside the lower of the boot easily to make the kind of fit adjustments that I like to make, which is either using, you know, some form of heat expansion and or grinding. When you have to arm wrestle the thing to get inside and work on it, that I'm not a big fan of that as the boot fitter, but that in the end isn't the reason why you buy or don't buy the BOA. I think the BOA has more marketing and market push than anything I've ever seen in ski boots in the last 50 years since 1969 and the introduction of Lang plastic boots to the marketplace.
There's certainly no stopping the BOA train, that's for sure.
No, and it's a real deal. It's one thing just to imagine that, oh, it's, you know, just some fly-by-night deal. I mean, these guys are working on products in all different sports. in the medical field. And now they've taken a look at, and actually they already existed pretty heavily in snowboarding. They had a lighter, thinner system they use for either closing liners or closing shells on snowboard boots. They are expanding and they're a real force and they're a real company with real people and a real building and real R&D. So on the one hand, it would be silly to just kind of poo-poo those guys and say, oh, they're not all they say they are. Right now, they're a way of getting into the boot that's different than four buckles. And whether or not, you know, in the end, that becomes the permanent trend in the industry. For me, from a guy who's worked on both sides, from the reality of performance and the marketing of that performance, there's still a piece that's missing from that equation with the BOA that's in the existing models that are on our shelves.
Couple more topics, then I'll release my dear listeners from this marathon podcast. Your life in skiing has taken you to the roof of the world, all over the world. Where are your favorite places to ski, and include any resorts where you only saw the race course, but you'd like to see the rest of the mountain? Where are your top destinations?
I would say that for me, the most amazing places are not on our continent, but places in Europe like Chamonix, like St. Anton in Austria, the Three Valleys in France. I mean, there's places that are just so expansive and so huge. So I tend to be drawn towards those types of places. And I'll give you an example why. Like St. Anton, for example, you can get up in the morning and leave from St. Anton, ski your way over to Lech and d'Azur's, go to St. Christophe, and work your way and land back in St. Anton for an after-skiing beer at the Moussevert at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. To me, that's this incredible experience of having all of these different peaks, all of these different exposures, and all different types of skiing in one place is really, really cool. When you get into North America, places you could have that experience are a little harder to find, although, you know, Whistler Blackcomb probably has elements of that. So that's one of my favorites in North America. Sun Valley, without a doubt, is amazing. I'd throw Utah into the mix with Snowbird and Alta, one of the most magical places on earth to ski. And without cutting myself short or cutting my nose off despite my face, living here in Tahoe, skiing at Palisades, either Alpine or Squaw side of it, Mount Rose, Mammoth, absolutely love skiing in Northern California, but it's home and I love to travel. So I would say that the expansive big places in Europe really attract me. And the places that have a lot of vertical, a lot of gravitational pull, like Snowbird, like Sun Valley, those are the kind of places that really attract me in North America.
Jim, soon you're going to be on the road coaching again. When and where are you heading off to, and who are you going to be coaching? And tell us a little bit about your athlete, if you can.
I have a combination of things going. I'm still working with some athletes on the World Cup that are in boots that I've worked on. And I will from time to time show up at events that they are at. But closer to what you're talking about, I'm actually headed to Copper Mountain shortly to coach a commercial camp. And I work with a company called Sports Club International. And we do camps in Colorado in the fall, in Whistler in the summer, Mount Hood, Chile, Argentina. So kind of all over the world, Europe in some cases. I'll work with kids that are younger in age, like U10s, U12s, all the way up to national team athletes. And locally, I'm working with Lila LaPagna, who is an American ski racer, primarily in slalom. And she has a World Cup spot, even though she's not a member currently of the US ski team. And so I do a lot of work with Lila, and more work lately because she had a fracture about 2 years ago now that has changed dramatically the way that her boot is set up. But along with that, there's other Tahoe athletes and US ski team athletes in different parts of the world that I will spend time with either locally or on the road or at camps that they're training on. So I try and mix up my year or my season into these kind of project periods where there's times when I'll do some on snow coaching. There's times when I'm working specifically on boot changes with athletes. And then there's times in the shop where I'm building boots and prepping boots for the preseason for athletes.
Are you looking for any more clients? And if so, how would someone get in touch with you?
Well, I'm not really ever looking for clients per se, but in the world of ski racing, it's a really a small community. And I'll tell you just a funny anecdotal story, but the way that I usually end up working with most athletes is the phone rings. And it'll be somebody saying, hey, this is so-and-so, and I'm having a problem, or I'd like to see you. And or a coach that has my number that will contact me and say, hey, I'm working with so-and-so, and we can't quite understand what's going on here. I'd like another set of eyes on it. Could you come down to Mammoth for this camp and have a look? And so back to the story of the humor of the phone. When I started my business, I was using my rep phone number when I was both working for Salomon and for Marker. And it's an unlisted number. And the whole joke in Tahoe was if you wanted to get in to see Jim, you had to have the phone number. Well, where do you get the phone number? And the deal is if someone didn't tell you the number, or you didn't get it from me, you couldn't call. And so we ran that program. Once we opened up the store, I think we opened the physical location in 2004, and I don't think we actually had a listed number until 2011. So we survived the first 7 years without a listed phone number, which means we didn't have, you know, an ad in the yellow pages. We didn't have our number in the white pages. And it was just one of those things where you had to go, you know, how to get a hold of that Jim Schaffner guy. So, you know, it was like a chairlift deal or a sitting at the bar deal, or, you know, somebody kind of going, hey, where do you get your boots done? Back to your question, how does somebody get a hold of me? And am I looking for new business? Well, I don't have a plaque out and I'm not advertising, but it's kind of an interesting thing where a little bit like being, you know, like a mystery guy, like the Lone Ranger, I'll just kind of show up when there's trouble in town.
That's sort of the perfect note for us to conclude on. I want to make sure that you're going to be around to test skis with me next spring.
Absolutely. I love that part of the year.
And it's always a kick for me to ski with you, my friend. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed my visit with Jim Schaffner, certainly one of the world's best boot fitters. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Jackson.